Accession number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 21.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 21. What was the composition of the battalion which went to Korea, Mr. Hawksworth?
Well, it was a standard formation, headquarters company, consisting of battalion quarters, the various specialist platoons, such as the signallers, the MT section, and the quartermaster's section, the four rifle companies, and a support company. Support company had not long been in vogue as far as the infantry battalions are concerned, but support company consisted of Vickers machine gun section, which had been reintroduced, having once been discarded after the 18 war. I think on account of the nature of the country which we're about to be engaged in activities in, the Vickers was brought in. Three-inch mortars, of course, were one of our close-line support weapons. The Bren carriers, which we would not be taking with us, we expected to be taken over upon arrival in Korea, and the anti-tank guns, which we had. As it transpired that we didn't take the anti-tank guns with us, nor the carriers. And no, to the best of my memory, we didn't collect carriers in Korea. However, they were not required. So we had a standard infantry battalion, battalion quarters, headquarters company, four rifle companies, and a support company.
The equipment and clothing, did this differ from what you'd had before?
It certainly did, but with particular reference to the clothing. In early days, as the listener will have read, most probably, when the uproar began in Korea and it was decided to send the United Nations force in against the aggressor, the first troops in, dispatched, I believe, from the Hong Kong garrison, including the famous Gloucester Regiment, were equipped with a normal standard type of uniform and basic equipment. Most importantly, the clothing aspect of the equipment, which was meant to combat the moderate climate, sufficiently warm enough anyway to keep the chaps warm in the Hong Kong climate. But whilst in Dortmund, as far back as Dortmund, one of the platoons in my company, in fact, platoon sergeant Ward's platoon, had been issued with a type of clothing destined for future use in severe climates or climates of severity, and they wore this clothing for possibly 6 weeks or so on troop trials, as it was known, under all conditions, and were deliberately sent out whenever it rained, snowed, or when it was excessively hot. This type of equipment we were issued with prior to embarkation for Korea proved to be an absolute boon and a most effective type of clothing. The weapons I've described already, the normal issue of personal weapons, rifle of course, the small mortar, the 2-inch mortar, the Patriot machine gun or the Sterling submachine gun, and bayonets and grenades, of course.
Was it still the 303 rifle?
Yes, it was. We had that time the number 4 Mark 1 rifle.
Did it differ in any way from the rifles used in the war itself?
Well, the Enfield rifle had been replaced shortly before the outbreak of war, and much to the older soldiers' disgust, this new type of rifle was brought in with certain modifications. The sighting arrangement, particularly the back sight, had been modified, I would say simplified. One either fired through the one aperture at a range of 100 yards, or on one adjustment which was available up to 300 yards. It had been considered by the experts, whom I consider amongst others to be amongst the base wallers, that one either fired at short range or certainly not further away than 300 yards. However, that was a decision that was taken, and this was a type of rifle that was eventually issued as a standard. So the standard rifle was the number 4 Mark 1, by which time we had proved to be an effective weapon. In fact, on our rifle range, we found that the simplified arrangement, as far as the sighting was concerned, assisted greatly in the training of recruits.
When did you set off for Korea?
We left for Korea early in July, in the month of July, and arrived about the 29th at the port of Busan, having embarked on the Empire Trooper at the port of Southampton somewhat earlier, a journey of some 5.5 weeks.
Had you had a send-off?
We had a terrific send-off. We left from the halt at Bransperth, where the troop train had been arranged to embark us. Well, I proceeded prior to the main battalion as a member of a small advance party by road. But the main party, from what I can gather, had a terrific send-off by the locals in Durham. People came from far and wide, even out of the county, to see them off. And upon arrival at Southampton, where I and the remainder of the advance party were already aboard the troop ship, there were visitors from all over the country down on the quayside, including our own regimental band, who of course were not to accompany us, and two other regimental bands, one from the tank regiment.
What do you recall of the journey itself?
Well, I by this time had experienced several journeys by sea on troop, properly equipped troop ships or troops converted for that very purpose. Remembering, casting my mind back as far as 1937, so I'd become more of a Marine now than a light infantry person. But it was interesting. A lot of my time was taken up by explaining to the chaps in my company what they were seeing, what it was all about, and what to expect further along the route.
Which company were you attached to?
I was C Company in those days.
Who was commanding officer?
Major Red Jackinson was the company commander.
And he'd had considerable wartime experience.
Yes, Reggie had a military cross, possibly two by that time, a very brave officer, a popular man with a battalion, with a vast amount of regimental experience, and he was also keenly interested in not only in regiment, but in regimental history.
Can you name the adjutant at second in command?
I think the adjutant on the way to Korea, and surely on arrival, was Tonkinson, later superseded by Peter Greenwell. The commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Peter Jeffries, and the name of the two I see escapes me just for the moment.
Your own platoon commanders, do you recall them?
Well, one was Bill Knott Bower, one was Michael McBain, and the third one, and this person's name I mentioned yesterday, I cannot recall at the moment.
On arrival at in Korea, Busan, I think you said, what was the situation there? What kind of an arrival did you have? What were your first impressions?
Well, we pulled alongside the dock early in the morning, shortly after breakfast. And on the dock side to welcome us was a United States Army band, comprised mainly of the gentlemen of a different hue, complete with the band leader, whistle and all, much to our amusement, and various obscene remarks were shouted through the porthole.
You would go ashore. What was the arrangements made for you?
We eventually disembarked, I should say, company by company, and entrained into the rail transport already awaiting us, shortly after which the journey north began. It was uneventful as far as train journeys are concerned. The interest of the troops, including myself, of course, was the surrounding countryside, which you could see as we travelled north. It was a beautiful country. It's an absolute shame that such a country had to be, in part, devastated by this act of war. The geographical situation of the country was absolutely beautiful. It was mountainous in places. There were plains in others. There were rivers which ran usually east to west across the country, and lots of forests, lots of vegetation, quite the opposite to the desert we were once being called upon to serve in.
The train journey, what was accommodation for the men?
The accommodation for the men was almost third class. We were in properly equipped passenger seats, produced to the standards required by the Common Oil Garden Korean Traveller, wooden seats, latted seats, and I seem to remember they were on the lines of open class tourist saloons, possibly 50 men to a coach.
So it was a relatively comfortable journey.
Oh yes, yes. Our heavy equipment had been stacked in the baggage vans attached to the train, and we had quite a pleasant, comfortable journey north. There were two or three stops at stations along the route. It didn't prove to be of much interest to us. We were keen to get to where we were bound.
I didn't ask you, had you had medicals and necessary injections before you'd started?
Oh, yes. In fact, back in Barnard Castle, before we left for the Yorkshire Moors, we'd received the usual treatment and attention from the medical side, the usual inoculations, which definitely this time did include yellow fever. And, of course, old sweats like myself by this time were quite used to it. Used to stand and take it. But it was a new experience for lots of the young National Servicemen who joined us, who complained bitterly once up on the Yorkshire Moors about this bloody hole in the arm.
Where did the train take you to?
The train took us up to a point somewhere north of Seoul. Now, the names of the various places in Korea are somewhat more difficult to pronounce and even remember than those in China. However, we were taken to and detrained at a place some miles north of Seoul into what was apparently a reserve area in order to spend a few weeks acclimatizing ourselves, during which time we received most interesting lectures by officers of various regiments who had previously served or presently serving in the line up at the front. I believe the most interesting one of all to us infantrymen was one given by the regimental commander of the New Zealand Regiment of Gunners, who were in our support area, or supporting our area. His claim, however, as to the accuracy of his gunners in support of certain patrolling activities, led one to believe he was bumming his load. We later believed that we'd been barking at the wrong tree. He was absolutely spot on. They were amongst the most accurate 25-pounder gunners that our battalion ever served with.
And the other thing, you said it was extremely interesting talk. What was he pointing out to you?
Well, he was pointing out also the very unbearable climate in which we were about to experience, there were three seasons to my memory, to the best of my mind, in Korea. The summer, which was an absolute beautiful time, not too hot, but hot enough to take off your shirt and vest without suffering any discomfort from sunburn. The autumn, which was one of the most delightful climates I've ever experienced. And the winter, which was enough to freeze the you know what off of a brass monkey.
You'd move into a camp there. What kind of camp was it? A temporary camp? A permanent camp?
Well, initially, if my memory serves me well, we were in a tented camp amongst some small trees, like an olive grove or something similar. Shortly after which we were taken up to an area which represented the type of terrain which would be our home for the next year or so. Hilly, extremely hilly. Already the prepared as a defensive position at company level, consisting of underground bunkers, slit trenches, fire trenches and fire positions, etc. We were led into these situations, and as I previously indicated, although several of us, old hats as we were by now, were absolutely used to this sort of thing, that to the new boys it was a novelty.
What were your activities? Obviously you were preparing for and getting experience before you moved in. What kind of activities were you doing?
Well, initially, of course, we were made to live in these holes in the ground, although for some unknown reason I prefer to sleep on the top. I've been ticked off on occasion by my company commander for doing so and setting a bad example, so I eventually had to go underground. After a few days, we experienced the types of digging which would have to be done, patrolling activities at night in the immediate area, the use of signals, the use of radio, which we're now becoming more proficient, adjusting ourselves to working with units on either flanks in close proximity, and even speaking to the supporting gunners on the radio, sending dummy calls for supporting weapon.
How long did this take place?
This lasted for about 3 weeks.
What happened to you then?
We were then sent up into the actual reserve line, some half a mile behind the main front line, where we continued our digging exercises. In fact, I think we wore quite a lot of shovels out whilst we were in Korea. Certainly I broke one or two. This was all leading up, of course, to the eventual time when we would take up our position actually in the front. By this time, we had noticed that the chaps were becoming rapidly acclimatized to this new style of life. And the most important aspect I should bring in at this time is the fact that, knowingly that the war has now reached a static stage, one couldn't run around during the hours of daylight looking for the enemy. The chink, as we was popularly called, and therefore a decision had been made of necessity to reverse the day and night procedures, and therefore, to all intents and purposes, when one was in the front line, and sometimes in certain reserve positions, all activity was carried out during the hours of darkness, and the hours of daylight were used for resting purposes.
This was a reversal in many ways to First World War methods.
Absolutely right. It was new to everyone. We'd trek day and night on a similar basis, both in the desert and in Italy. But this war developed into an intense patrol activity situation. The Chinese occupied the heights opposite the various valleys, and we on the hills opposing them, or in front of them, with the valley floor in between, sometimes as much as a mile across. So a decision had been made to reverse our normal routines and a daily routine. Let's start at tea time in the early evening. the troops would be about the business in the trenches, cleaning the weapons, cleaning the grenades, and preparing for any particular night offensive which may develop. Later in the evening, as the darkness approached, they would attend to maintaining the wire defences in front of the fire positions and also to the rear. By this time, of course, we realised that being in a defensive position, all-round defence was the order of the day and night, and therefore not only did we attend to the forward slopes, but also our rear security at all times. By about 10 o'clock at night, when it was completely dark, the platoon cooks, by this time, in the neatly constructed underground cookhouse areas, would be preparing the main meal of the day or night, to which the troops would attend when called forward, leaving sentries in on guard. By midnight, certainly, the meal would have been partaken of by all the members, everything cleaned up and put away, and the night duties would commence.
What would they entail?
It has long been the policy of the British infantry, when placed in such a situation, to develop an intense patrol activity in order to secure and maintain the occupation of the intervening no man's land area. Therefore, to this end, the main occupation of the Commonwealth Guard and infantryman at night was concerned with attending to patrol duties, whether it be a fighting patrol, a reconnaissance patrol, or a standing patrol. A fighting patrol needs no explanation, of course. One went out looking for the enemy and beat him up accordingly. A reconnaissance patrol, self-explanatory also. A small patrol, usually led by an officer or a senior NCO, with as few men as possible, would creep out and attempt to gain the information that had been instructed so to do. A standing patrol didn't necessarily mean that the chap stood upright near the wire all night. They did, in fact, occupy a position near certain gaps in the defensive wire, absolutely forward, in order to control the entry and egress of friendly troops.
Did you experience any of these patrols personally?
No, I attended only one. I attended only one standing patrol when called upon to do so in an emergency. Previously, shortly after arrival in Korea and into the reserve position, my company commander decided upon a plan of organisation once we're in the front line, and that would be that the second in command, Captain Percy, would remain at B echelon in charge of our supply base, along with the colour sergeant, whose job it properly was, attended with by the company clerk, who kept the local record. In the line, during the hours of the day, I was to be in charge. The remainder of the troops, not necessarily engaged on menial tasks, possibly half a dozen or so, and the constant watch, and the company commander would take advantage and get some rest.
Was that an unusual arrangement, to have one second in command like a B echelon?
At first instance, I thought it was rather a strange arrangement. Yes, I thought so, but looking back at it and having experienced it, it turned out to be a most excellent arrangement. One considers that a second in command is supposedly in instant readiness to assume command should the company commander become a casualty. Well, in a mobile situation, he would be in close contact. However, in a static situation, and living as we were with reasonable shelter, this possibility, apart from a mass attack, was remote. And in any case, if the company commander is living cheek by jowl with the second in command, and they have an incoming shell or mortar, and both are killed, then there is no relieving officer to take charge. We've experienced this on the island, of course, when fatalities occurred, when an O group with officers in close proximity, as an awful situation developed. And therefore, this arrangement was laid down by the company commander, and it worked exceedingly well. The company commander would be sleeping or resting by day, so would the troops who were not otherwise engaged. I would be moving around the company area, ensuring that the trenches had been swept clean, and I mean swept clean. Reggie Atkinson, our company commander, was extremely strict as to the hygiene, both personal and living quarters. Living quarters, yes, they were living quarters. We lived in these holes in the ground, and they had to be kept clean. Rats abounded in Korea. The countryside at one time had been cultivated regularly, and sometimes three crops of rice, alfalfa, and other seed crops were obtained. During the war, of course, the natives had fled, and the crops had continued to grow, the seed dropping on the floor, added to which there were, of course, and one has to accept this fact, certain dead bodies lying around, which was a happy hunting ground as far as the rats are concerned. So trench hygiene was of the utmost importance, and even when on the odd occasion when we did partake of rations from tins, every tin had to be flattened and bent double before it was disposed of, and every tin having contained food and used on our cut position was taken out regularly by our colour sergeant in the transport with which he brought in the rations.
Did it in effect mean that the night time was your time of rest, your time of rest?
In theory, as I previously said, the organisation was absolutely marvellous. It was a perfect arrangement. Although the old saying was that the company sergeant major, certainly myself, used to remind the men constantly, if there's anything you want from me at any time at all, day or night, come and let me know. This they took literally, and I'm not afraid to say, although I was occasionally annoyed. They did take me at my word and come along and arrive me from my slumbers. But for all that, one can't easily go to sleep. Certainly one never took one's boots off. It's difficult to run in your bare feet. I used to find the necessary rest either during the day, leaning up against a post, semi-dozing, or trying to sleep in the evening, fully dressed. Nevertheless, I've got no complaints. If I couldn't sleep at night when I was supposed to be sleeping, I was out amongst the men.
Did you find, Perth, that this became a strain over a period of time?
Yes, there's no doubt about that. The periods of time spent in the front line varied. Occasionally, it differed. Sometimes it was shorter. Usually it was greater length. And at one time we spent, we spent 6 weeks, a total of 6 weeks in the front line without relief. But at the end of which I felt physically shattered.
You've mentioned the accommodation in the sense of having these holes and pits to live in. How difficult was it living under those conditions? Were you able to make them comfortable?
Well, the British soldier is well known for being able to, make his pit cosy, and in no time at all, our chaps, having had a few weeks previously their first introduction to this mode of existence, soon got used to the idea, and from nowhere at all produced odd items of furniture, such as a one-legged table or cardboard. The colour sand, Tom Hodgson, who was an excellent chap, would, when available, of course, bring up sheets of cardboard or a piece of corrugated iron, which the men put to good use. So they were comfortable, And as I say, during my tour of duty during the day, I occasionally visited their sleeping quarters, and usually they were all snoring their heads off.
What were they sleeping in? Were they sleeping bags or that kind of material?
Well, we had excellent equipment. We had sleeping bags, which in the first instance were zipped up the side, later replaced with ties. But they had these sleeping bags with non-inflammable filling. They had an adequate supply of blankets. I've already mentioned the windproof, weatherproof combat clothing with which we've been issued. And so we were possibly the first troops into the line to be fully equipped and adequately protected against the variable climate.